Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Well, what I was asked to do today was to talk about my Zen life as part of that series. And as opposed to a Zen life, for me anyway, I see this more as a spiritual life versus Zen, because Zen has come in fairly late in my life. I'm 69, and you know, it's going into a number of years now. So the question is, why am I sitting here today instead of being on the beach somewhere having a margarita, or you know, sitting at home or out playing or something like that? And what I'd like to do is sort of explain where I started from and why I'm here now. I was raised in a fairly conservative, I guess you'd say, Christian household, nuclear family. Dad worked, mom stayed home and raised us kids. We didn't have a lot of money. My dad's great-grandfather was a Lutheran minister, missionary in India. My grandfather was born just after the Civil War, and had my dad late in life. My grandmother, same thing, born in England. I strongly suspect it was sort of I'm pregnant sort of idea thing. She was old as well. And so my dad was raised, and my mom was raised, born in the Canadian prairies, and moved to Vancouver during the Depression, both raised during the Depression. And so both of them came from a fairly a generation back of where many of their peers came from older parents' sort of idea. They raised us in this conservative church, as I said, called the Plymouth Brethren Number 4. I think we had a speaker a year or so ago. The minister that was at Unitarians was also a different branch of the Plymouth Brethren, but these fundamentalists, they have a literal translation of the Bible versus many of the mainstream churches in the U.S. An example is we didn't listen to the radio or have a TV because the devil was the prince of the air, and those two mediums came across through the air, therefore they were of the devil. You know, he's that sort of thing. But one of the things that they also, you know, Ten Commandments, same as many Christians or most Christian churches. The one that really sort of formed me was the commandment not to kill. And that sort of has been a stand, or one of the constant themes through my life. That's important because my dad, during Second World War, had been in the Navy and started out in Navy commandos. The church I grew up and the Quakers, both those two churches were the groups in the U.S. that got through the concept of being a conscientious objector, where during Second World War, where you would not refuse to kill people. And he became a conscientious objector, and that's the way I was raised. You just didn't kill people, and that just is sort of a given. No firearms, all that sort of stuff. And so when I was 16, same as most males, or all males in the U.S., you had to sign up for the draft. And so I signed up as a conscious objector. I could have gone two ways, total objection to military service, or just objecting to bearing arms, learning how to kill people. And so it'd be exciting. I was 16, so I signed up as a 1AO, just not carrying weapons. And so you know, that's been, as I said, a fairly constant theme. With the Plymouth Brethren, they didn't have a formal ministers, a formal hierarchy of church elders or anything. It was sort of the consensus of the group that would determine who, you know, led services, that sort of thing. And the group would decide this person's more spiritual than that, and so they'd ask you to do more in the way of providing services. And when I was about 16, about the time I signed up for the draft, the people who sort of ran it, were considered to be the most spiritual, considered that I was a good candidate to become one of those leaders. And I was starting to be schooled to, you know, become a leader and lead services, give sermons, all that sort of thing. And it seemed very strange to me, because I wasn't even really certain I believed the whole Christian dogma, and yet I was being expected to get up and expound on some aspect of the Bible, and is it true? And, you know, I was in a real quandary. It just didn't feel right. You know, I was a phony. All those sorts of things kept going through my mind when I would get up to expound on something. And, you know, this, I was being asked more and more frequently to give up and give a sermon on whatever. And I just, it was difficult to do, even though it was expected of me. And about that time, and I had started school early in kindergarten. I graduated early. I started college at a young age, and I was nowhere near ready to be in college. And so I flunked out, no question. I mean, I was just in the conversation, 0 point, whatever. And so I was drafted, or I knew I was going to be drafted, so I flunked out. I lost my college exemption. So, and about that same time, I was not wanting to do this whole religious thing anymore. So I volunteered for the draft, knowing that I was, at the time, knowing I was going to become a medic and I was going to go to Vietnam. There's no question in my mind. That's just what happened. While I was in this, when I first started in the military after I was drafted, it was actually one of the first times that I really started learning a lot more about religion, you know, outside of the church I'd grown up in. Everyone I was going through basic training with were conscience objectors, a wide variety of religions. But a lot of the people there were there claiming that they had been some sort of religious thing that allowed them to be conscious objectors, and they weren't. These are people with their doctorates or master's degrees, and you know, a lot of philosophy majors, that sort of stuff, that were able to somehow get an exemption from carrying arms. And so we would, after we'd done all our military training during the day, after lights out, we would sit up for several hours, usually every night, discussing religion, discussing philosophy, that sort of thing, I really started learning and becoming more interested in other ways of thinking besides the standard Christian way. I graduated from that. They sent me to an NCO academy where I learned how to lead people, how to manage organizations and people, whatnot, and then went through my medic training, and was sent to Vietnam. you know, as I expected, as were most of the people I went to school with. When I went there, it was sort of interesting. I took three books with me, the Bible, of course, small version, a book, a philosophy book by John Locke, who was one of the philosophers that I had sort of zeroed in on and had read a lot of, and then, don't ask me why, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I don't know, that's what I had. So anyway, those are the books I had with me in Vietnam. And during that time, I really started to, when I first got there, I really learned the subject that is this month's focus for the Zen Center, impermanence. You know, you'd be talking to somebody and the next second they'd be dead, or they'd have their leg blown off or whatever. And so it really, you know, hit me hard. I was 18. And I learned the philosophy, or, you know, the mindset, my philosophy of mindset, that couldn't really worry about anything, because if you were gone, you wouldn't know anything about it because you'd be dead, so you just didn't worry about it to start with. You know, whatever happened, happened. And that's, you know, good or bad, that's sort of the way I live my life right now. And this is not just sort of the way it is. When you're out on patrol, all of a sudden, you know, a firefight would erupt, someone around you would be killed or injured, whatever. I'd do my thing, of course, as an addict. But you really learned how fragile life is, how it can be gone in an instant, and it's, you know, that always has stuck with me. So I was there for about 13 months, I guess, and came back to the States when I was, between my 19th and 20th birthday. I was discharged from the military about 5 days after I'd been in combat, and just sort of, moped around, but had no real focus in my life. My mom later said that I came back completely different than mentally and the way I acted than when I had gone into the service. I did a lot of things to do sort of service to the community. I taught almost immediately. I started teaching American Red Cross advanced first aid and CPR classes, which I did for many, many years. Because I had been technically drafted from working for the city, it was a summer job for me, but, you know, that's just the way it worked. I was able, a few days after getting back from Vietnam, to immediately go back to work for the city of Seattle. And I was sitting there, I guess looking pretty forlorn, and this old man, probably 45, walked up to me, and he flipped out a lit a pot. And over the years, for the next couple of years, we became pretty close friends. And I'd never really smoked pot in Vietnam, because I saw early on that that's where people got killed, when they were hot. So, but we became good friends, and we wanted to build a retreat center for disabled veterans from Vietnam primarily, but whoever, but we needed money, and both of us were poor, starving part of the time, that sort of thing. And I was back in school as well, so he looked in a lot of books and found that donations were generally given to Protestant organizations. And so we formed the American Free Lutheran Church. It was real simple. We became a Protestant. We actually were Universal Life and had a doctrinal schism with the Universal Life. And so we formed our own church. And so we could try to collect donations. Of course, nothing worked. Got no money, but it was fun. He had grown up with the Weyerhaeuser kids and in Tacoma. And so he went to George Weyerhaeuser, and George told him, well, if you can get land, I'll give you all the wood you need to build this retreat center. We had an architect on the board who had designed all that sort of stuff. And so he went to the Simpson family, those two families are related through marriage, and tried to get land. They said, we'll give you land up on Stevens Pass if you can get the wood. And he could never get the two families together, and so he decided that he would start a bingo game to raise money. It became the biggest bingo game in the state at that time. Bingo was brand new. Gambling was illegal at the time. Churches could do it. And we never made any money because it was all stolen by some of the workers who were part of Frank Calipercio. He was a mafia guy in Seattle. They were his employees, and they stole the money. We tried to get out from under Frank, and because we didn't want him stealing the money, and we went to somebody else's Zeke Grand Cross. Well, it turns out it's, you know, from the fat into the frying pan or whatever, the frying pan into the fire. The guy that Zeke went to was actually organized crime in the city, and Frank had threatened to kill us, and Al Bickle, the organized crime guy, said, I'll take care of it. He picked up the phone Frank Calipercio and said, Zeke and Jim, anything happens to him, you're dead, and slammed the phone down. He says, that's taken care of. So that was the end of that. We still never made any money, and because Al stole it all. And so, but it was still an attempt on my part to try to help other people. Anyway, that was sort of the point of this whole thing. During this time, I was going to school as well, and after a couple of years, I getting flunked out of college and at the University of Washington, actually, and had to figure out what to do. So I talked to some family friends in Los Angeles who said, you need to start a screen printing business, because I only had $75 and I had to do something, you know, to raise money. And so I borrowed about $500 from my parents and went into business. And slowly over time, the business grew to the point where I had about 26 employees. I still wasn't making a ton of money, but, you know, it paid the bills, sort of idea. And but it was just a grind. We had to do about 200 dozen shirts a day to break even, and had to do more than that to actually make money. And but it was fun from the side that we hired employees. I hired employees who were just re-entering the job market out of jails, prisons, welfare, you know, those sorts of things, to teach them to work again and to have a budget their money. You know, at lunchtime, I would teach them the envelope system of budgeting money. Every Friday when I paid them, they put a certain amount, supposedly anyway, into each envelope. So come rent time, they had rent money, they could buy a bus, you know, fare, that sort of stuff. And, you know, a lot of people benefited from it, which was gratifying. And then during this period, I met Joyce, who got married, moved to Vashon. I joined the fire department, sort of rose up in there to the assistant chief and medical officer, and eventually just got tired of the whole business thing and tried to sell it. I finally told it to employ. I got skipped the whole thing, but that's the way it was. And went back to college, got my bachelor's in nursing, became a nurse. And then later went back and did my master's in community health nursing and worked there for a while. During that, my master's program, I helped develop a demo program for homeless vets and worked on housing issues for people who are homeless in general. After working as a clinical nurse specialist for a couple of years, went back, did a family nurse practitioner, and worked with mentally ill in Tacoma, people in a locked psych hospital, just in primary care. While in the psych hospital, I met someone called Robbie Pellet, who's a Buddhist priest in Tacoma. I don't know what variety. I, at that time, wasn't familiar with all the flavors of Buddhism. But he had trained in Japan for many years, and he was a CDMHP, someone who was legally authorized to detain people for mental health reasons, for safety for themselves or others. And I was, both of us were working nights for a couple of years. And so when neither of us was working, which is most of the time, I would say, if neither of us were called out to see somebody, we would talk about Buddhism and philosophy of life. And we had a great conversation, sometimes for 6 hours a night, just chatting away, which, got me a little bit more interested in spiritual type stuff. During that time period at the psych hospital, I also helped a friend get his tax exempt status for an organization he started that puts schools for girls into rural Afghanistan. And so we've been doing that now. We're working on our eighth school, raising money for our eighth school right now. So again, trying to help other people. About 4 years after starting that job, I got tired of it and moved to do some research at the University of Washington in pulmonary rehabilitation, and worked it for about a year before I had a horrible fall and was off work for a year, had to find another job afterwards, and landed a job doing multiple cirrhosis research at the rehab research at the Seattle VA. And eventually that worked into both the research and the clinical care job. Towards the tail end of doing the VA stuff before I retired, Joyce and I started going to a program that Seattle U has run for many years called Search for Meaning. And what that is it's a whole series of seminars, lectures you can go to. I think they now charge to go, but it was free at the time. Authors primarily, who have written books on various aspects of spiritual stuff, caring for others, caring for yourself, that sort of thing. And it was also a book fair. So we started buying books based on that. One of the lectures we went to there was done primarily by a woman who had been a Catholic, got interested in Buddhism, went to Nepal, I believe it was, because she was in the monastery the Dalai Lama had, was a Buddhist nun for about 20 years, and then decided Catholicism still had a strong pull on her, came back to the U.S., and she was a strong Catholic then, but still used many of her Buddhist principles and ideas in her just routine life. And that got both Joyce and I more interested in Buddhism. One of the other speakers at that was a Buddhist teacher. I don't think he's a priest or anything, who's actually on faculty at Seattle U, who does a Zen meditation group at Seattle U in their chapel once a week. And so we went to that for a number of times, and it was just too long a commute to get back late at night and then have to get up and go to work the next morning. And Joyce had gone to, remembered that we had gone to something somewhere where I believe it was Koshi had talked, and so we knew there was a Zen group on island, and so we started coming to the Zen Center, and we're here. During all of this, throughout my whole life, I've never had a spiritual crisis where I had to work through to sort of come to terms with something that led me to here. It's just been sort of a whole series of things that I've done over my life helping others, concern for others. I've always believed there's some sort of something else out there besides what we see, the four walls sort of idea. I grew up with stories of my great-grandfather throwing demons and spirits out of houses when he was a missionary in India. My dad's sister had she had a fortune told, and she was actually given the entire, exactly what was going to happen to her throughout her life. And it's down to very, very specific things that happened exactly as predicted, which, you know, those sorts of, when I was younger, you know, 12, 14, 16, I remember sort of going out of my body, looking down. You know, things like that just sort of have led me to believe there's something else out there. I don't know what it is. You know, I looked at reincarnation earlier in my life through a lot of reading that I did, and I am not really certain that's for real. But whatever it is, whether it's a, you know, life force, a spirit that moves on, whatever, come back again, I don't know. But that's, you know, it's sort of out there, and in my mind anyway, and we, you know, it's part of how I live my life. I can't find my last notes page, but whatever. But one thing I am certain of is that I think my life, I have to, and what I've tried to do throughout my life is serve others, help others, you know, sort of live by the golden rule sort of idea, follow the precepts that I actually took again earlier this year, the Buddhist precepts, not to kill, not to tell lies, no sexual misconduct, don't steal, those sorts of things. And I think if we live those sorts of our lives using those sorts of precepts, that it's a good basis for us to improve the status of the world. That's it. Are there any questions? The 1 minute remaining?
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.